Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Emery Roan joins me, as well as Christopher Koopman and Anna Alba Betancourt. We're going to talk Uber economics, public domain day, Monster Cat, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Emery Roan, episode 333, recorded January 15th, 2016. Who the EFF are you? This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/twill. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and I'm here with my co-host and our intern, Emery Roan. Hi, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here again.
Wonderful to have you back. For those of you who don't remember Emery's last recent appearance on the show, he is our intern here at This Week in Law. He's got a couple of other internships he's got going on at the same time, too. While he's going to law school, he's interning with New Media Rights and the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse.
Minor point, I did just actually finish my internship at New Media Rights. I can only manage two internships and a full course load at one time, but I am here at the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse. It's an excellent nonprofit that offers consumer-facing education and advocacy in privacy issues. So you can check them out at privacyrights.org. We are reorganizing our website in the next year or so, but it's a great resource.
Phew, I was getting a little worried about you being overcommitted there, Emery. That's a good thing. No. trying to balance it all. Emery's also going to school at California Western School of Law down the road from me in San Diego. So great to have you back, Emery.
Thanks.
And we have two wonderful guests joining us today from the Queen Mary University of London School of Law is Anna Alba Betancourt. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Denise. Thank you for inviting me. I'm actually not in London, as you can see from the brightness.
Yes, it does look a little bright from London.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yes.
But you are a post-grad researcher there, correct?
I actually finished recently. My Viva and everything is already done. So now I'm doing a research visiting at the UNAM, at the University of Mexico.
Oh, wonderful. So... yeah. Emery's finished his internship. You've finished your research and have moved on to others. Your spare time when you're not researching, you're also an intellectual property attorney based in Mexico, correct?
Exactly.
Wonderful. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Also joining us from the George Mason University is Professor Christopher Koopman. He teaches in both the economics department and the law school at George Mason and is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Denise. Thank you for letting me join your show today.
Wonderful to have you. We've got some great topics to discuss today, so let's get right to it. We're going to start out by looking at some issues of legislation and policy. Chris, you brought to my attention the Great British Curry Crisis, and I think this is a wonderful entree to talking about Uber, which you have done quite a bit of economics and law-related research on. One of the unintended disruptive consequences of Uber operating in London seems to be that curry restaurants are struggling. Can you explain the connection between those two things?
Yeah, so for the most part, the discussions and the controversy surrounding Uber and Lyft and all the other ride-sharing companies that have really gotten popular over the last few years is that they're disrupting taxi companies, the old incumbent established on-demand transportation services that cities have across the world. But what we're now finding is that they're also disrupting other industries as well. And this is just another example of the way that the sharing economy, sort of the broad categorization for all of these apps and platforms that are providing ways for people to connect and work, the way that it's providing new opportunity and new flexibility for these workers. So what you're seeing is Curry House owners and operators in London are upset because all of their workers are fleeing the kitchens across the city and now driving for Uber. So it's really putting a lot of pressure on these restaurants to find people who are willing to work on a fixed schedule in an environment like a restaurant.
So I'm sure there are probably other industries that are finding they're losing workers to a more independent, self-directed kind of job arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you could probably see this story playing out in some ways in every industry where you have a lot of entry-level employment. For example, where in terms of the workforce, where the sharing economy is really growing and booming is for people who are otherwise at the bottom of the ladder, if you will, when it comes to employment opportunities, or those who have been left out of the traditional workforce altogether. So it's providing new ways for people to take what they have or what they have access to. In this instance, it's a car. All you really need is a car and a license, or access to a car and a license. And now all of a sudden you can work on your own terms and have the flexibility and the freedom that come along with being able to set your own schedule, as opposed to working on a line in a kitchen, which is pretty rigid with regard to when you have to be there and how long and when and where you can go while you're at work. So it really is, I think, disrupting not only what we would think is the traditional taxi industries, but then also all of these other industries where there are a lot of people who are both seeking opportunity and flexibility in their work environments.
Hmm. Anna, in Mexico, what is the status of Uber? Does it exist? Is it allowed to operate there?
Yeah, actually, I'm very surprised, happily surprised that it works perfectly. I think it would have like a big issue regarding to security, you know? I don't know. I was very doubtful. I was using Uber a lot when I was in London, and it wasn't that big yet when I left. It was like because they also have other applications that do the same stuff. But I think that Uber makes it just easier. So when I came to Mexico City, I thought Uber was going to be an issue because of security, because you never know who's the person driving the car. But I'm really glad that the company did so well in taking steps to secure passengers, that they were going to be okay, and yeah, it's really, really big now, and it's expanding in other cities, in other big cities in Mexico as well. And they had a lot of problems. Well, I've heard from the drivers, from the Uber drivers, that they also quitted their jobs as drivers from someone else. They were the driver of a person that could afford a driver. And or they were even driving like big trucks around the country, and instead of that, they switched to Uber. I mean, I can see why would they. I mean, the way the Uber company works, I think they make it really easy, but at the same time, they ask for a high standard for the drivers. This is what they told me. I don't know. I haven't made sure of this, but they even make a test, psychology test, to see who are their employees. No, like you're not hiring a crazy person. And I think this system of both the passenger and also the driver, like putting a mark on each other, like they do say like what 5 stars or 4 stars. For the passenger and the passenger doing the same about the driver makes it like even a very appealable thing for you to move and use it, no? Yeah, and I think they had a lot of problems here, at least with the normal taxi companies, and I think also they did in London, no? Mm-hmm. Like all the taxi, the normal taxi, the regular taxis are like really upset with Uber because they had to go through so many tests. And also in London, for instance, to own a black taxi, mm-hmm. it's a really prestigious thing. Like they would do very complicated tests even about the city and how to get to the different places. Because, I mean, of course, these tests, you know how English people like the, I would say the customs and to prevail the customs. And I mean, this was before the GPX existed. So they had to do like very complicated tests about the geography of the city in order to be able to be a driver of a black cab. So there's, yeah. it's a very complicated system. And then suddenly then you have this big competence from Uber with people that had the job in a way very easily, you know?
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, Chris, what you think is going to happen here. Obviously, Uber has been a runaway success. It's shaken up a lot of people, angered a lot of people. We're going to talk about their pricing, both for consumers and for drivers in a moment. But let's look at the what you think, gazing into your crystal ball, will happen on the regulatory front. It seems to me that if things continue as they are, the traditional taxi cab industry will wither and or die. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but there are probably regulators and cab drivers and black cab drivers in London being a good example, who would rather not see that happen. So do you think that government will step in and put controls on this and sort of prop up the taxi industry, or do you think it will just die?
Yeah, I'm not sure, and I think it probably depends on the city or the state or even the country where this is happening. Will most likely the what will happen will vary on those grounds. So I think you know the whole spectrum of responses has been covered more or less by states across America. So that's typically where I focused my research, and so you have. Responses like Colorado and California very early on that created some regulations but allowed Uber and Lyft and these other platforms to compete. And then you have other responses. For example, in Virginia where I live, for some time the state tried to ban Uber and Lyft. And then you have everything in between. But going forward, I think what you'll see is for the most part, the debates over the existence of Uber and Lyft are settled. Uber and Lyft are here to stay. It's just now all of these second order and third order issues that regulators have to figure out. And this is where you're seeing a lot of the state legislators pick up these issues this winter and spring is how do we regulate Uber and Lyft? What do we treat them as? In particular, what many states are doing are giving them this separate designation. So California and Colorado were early on in adopting this transportation network company designation. And that's more or less been the model that other states have adopted. But what you see, and this is something that Anna brought up and that you just brought up also, is that by giving Uber and Lyft this sort of special status, that is treating taxis the way you've always treated taxis with a very heavy regulatory hand, and then allowing Uber and Lyft to have this other route for regulation, it creates a lot of inequities in the way that these companies are treated. And in particular, I think what you're seeing in Florida, so you're seeing a lot of cities across Florida where the taxis and livery services are regulated at a city and municipal level, is you're seeing them just do a blanket deregulation or a blanket reduction in regulations, saying, okay, the market has changed since the 1930s when most of these taxi laws have been put into place. And the entry of Uber and Lyft and ride sharing in general is an opportunity not to just to figure out how do we treat these new companies, but also to critically evaluate the way that they're treating the old companies. And what you're seeing in Florida is they're saying, all right, we agree with you, taxis. It's not fair that Uber is under-regulated or unregulated or deregulated or whatever it is people are saying about Uber, but you shouldn't be over-regulated. So trying to find the least common denominator between the two and regulate on that level, as opposed to trying to bring regulations up on Uber and Lyft to the level of taxis. So I think that's what you're – the debates, what you're really going to be seeing over the next 6-8 months, a year to a year and a half, are how do we treat taxis and Ubers now that they're both in the system. But then also you're going to see issues like employment status, benefits, Social Security, and everything else that comes along with the traditional employment designation, in particular because these platforms do not work in an employment setting. They work in an independent contractor setting. So all of these other issues coming along with, you know, what in terms of benefits should be provided to them, what about Social Security and all of the other programs that we've tied, in particular in the United States, to employment.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. I'll take a stab at some of the more interesting points. First, though, I want to just point out, as Virgil, one of our regular listeners in IRC, is pointing out, that also the courts will be involved in shaping how this develops, as well as lawmakers. Virgil is pointing out that where he lives, there's a $400 million lawsuit being brought against Uber by the cab companies. I'm not sure where that is. But I'm sure that's also not the only lawsuit being brought to determine, and I think a lot of the lawsuits probably do involve these employment issues and back pay and treating people as independent contractors who are alleged to actually be employees. So there's going to be a lot of that to shake out as well. Do you think, Chris, that to address the new model, assuming they can clear the hurdles, the labor and employment law hurdles of allowing drivers to remain designated as independent contractors, do you think that we'll see some sort of creative pooling of resources by people who are drivers saying, okay, we're, you know, if we can't get the traditional benefits that an employer would provide us, we're going to band together and be a force that can have some negotiating power to get those kinds of benefits that such as an employer could get. Do you think we'll see that?
Yeah, perhaps. And I think you're seeing that play out right now. So just to back it up a bit, you are right that many of these issues are going to play out in court. But it's really unclear how those will be resolved. In particular, there's a class action lawsuit in California over a misclassification of Uber and Lyft drivers, two separate cases. And they're going to a jury. And the jury essentially is going to be resolving this question. And I believe the federal judge, when he was when he issued his decision that it would go to a jury and move forward in the process, basically said a jury would be given a square peg and the option of two round holes. And it's up for a jury to decide, because he, quite honestly, I don't think wanted to resolve it himself, given how unclear the law was. So you do see there's a lot of there's a lack of clarity in the law, but in courts may in fact end up stepping in and driving a lot of these resolutions, as legislators say, you know, it's just too politically difficult for us to try to balance a very large company with a very large constituency like Uber, alongside also a very powerful constituency, and that is, you know, the local cab companies. But to your second point about pooling together, that's interesting, because I haven't seen you know, Uber drivers or Lyft drivers or sharing economy participants. It's important to remember, you know, Uber and Lyft are sort of the big headline grabbing pieces of the sharing economy, but the sharing economy spans pretty much every industry at this point, from transportation to hospitality to on-demand personal shopping to on-demand maids and all sorts of things. So it'll be interesting to see if the pooling of resources ends up being across industries as well. My guess would be that a lot of these issues will be resolved as companies realize that there is a huge demand for, let's say, flexible insurance or flexible benefits packages that that these independent contractors can buy into and get the type of security and benefits that come along with traditional employment. But it's also important to remember that, given the lack of clarity in the law with regard to, are these platforms just simply using independent contractors, or are they misclassifying employees? The more benefits and the more things that these platforms provide to these workers, the more likely it is that they may accidentally cross that line into being designated as an employer rather than simply just a platform. So the lack of clarity in the law, I think, is also holding back these companies from providing the types of things that they might otherwise provide as they continue to fiercely compete for not just consumers in the market, but workers as well. Like I said, this is it's a highly competitive market, and it's disrupting traditional industries, and you're seeing workers leaving things like curry houses in London to work in these platforms. But you're also seeing workers work on multiple platforms at one time. I don't have an exact number, but just anecdotally, a large proportion of the people driving for Uber, at least across the United States, are also driving for Lyft or some other platform as well. And they just switch to whichever company is offering the better deal at the moment. So this could, in fact, just be another margin that is the offering benefits and other things to workers, could just be another margin upon which these companies compete as they continue to try to grow both their market share when it comes to consumers, but also for workers as well.
Christopher, I'd love to hear your opinion on this, but it feels like to me that so much of the issue – it doesn't really come down to sort of an employee or independent contractor relationship, but really just flexibility of the ability to work. I mean, I think that there are plenty of Uber drivers that would love to be considered employees and would, you know, continue to work for Uber as long as they could keep that flexible schedule and work where they want. You know, I feel like so much of it is that it's, you know, it's 2016 and you can't just have one job and you've got to be hustling. And so just with the restaurant industry, if, you know, these restaurants had more flexible hours, do you think that we'd see the same sort of situation or the same issues?
Perhaps. I guess if your question is, could restaurants compete to get these workers back by being more flexible with their time? That's really difficult because a restaurant has to have workers there all of the time, and they have to tell workers, you need to show up and be here because customers are constantly going to be coming in and requesting food. So you got to be making food all of the time. But when it comes to ride sharing, I think it's more fluid than that, especially given the fact that people have multiple options. And there are, you know, sometimes your car could be 2 minutes away. Sometimes your car could be 10 minutes away. It really just depends on what's out there on the other side of the platform, that is those people willing to drive. But I think if two things, if the companies were to then designate, that is Uber and Lyft and the other ride sharing companies were to designate their drivers employees, they would lose a lot. The workers would lose a lot of that flexibility because now all of a sudden when you're an employee, you have to show up on time. You have to work every day. You have to do what your boss tells you. And also something that I don't think has been mentioned enough is that if these platforms were in fact deemed employers, it would be very easy for them to then have drivers sign a non-compete that says when you sign up and work with us, you're not allowed to work for any other platform in transportation. So rider or drivers would be losing a lot of that freedom and flexibility and ultimately a lot of the bargaining power that they do have currently, in that, you know, as quick as it is for you to change from your Instagram to Facebook apps, it's as easy for a driver to go from being an Uber driver to a Lyft driver. And I think that's a very real threat for these companies. And that's why they're sort of thrusting all sorts of benefits, that is, and guaranteed fares, and promising all types of money to new drivers, is to try to get them in the system and drive for them as they continue to compete for drivers.
Well, that's certainly an opportunity for regulators to step in. And in certain states, non-competes are not legal to begin with. In California, that wouldn't fly. But elsewhere, it might very well. But my one anecdotal example of someone working in this economy does exactly what you just pointed out, Chris. He shifts between Uber and Lyft. I don't think he does anybody else. And I'm curious to take all of your pulse about what you think the actual real competition in this sphere is. But he drives for Uber and Lyft at will. He drives for taxi companies at will. They don't seem to lock him out because he's also driving for Uber and Lyft. And just to put the cherry on top, he has his own business, his own ride company where drivers work for him, or, you know, are independent contractors for him. So it's a very interesting bunch of options that he's presented with, and he's working them all, which is just wonderful to see. Anna, you mentioned that you've used other services besides Uber, but you found their experience to be the most pleasant, the most reliable for you. What do you think the state of competition for Uber is in the places that you've experienced it?
Well, I think from what I heard here in Mexico is that the other taxi companies, sometimes they get together, like all the taxi drivers, into a collective, and they used to have a phone number where you could call them and they would come to your house, etc. This we call them, in London, they would call them minicabs. So they were like regular, not like a black cab, like a regular car without any sign of if being a taxi. And then you will check which one is the nearest to your to the place where you were. They could tell you it's exactly like you, or they would tell you exactly how much would it be to the place where you want to go, and then they would send you someone. But they didn't have this system of rating the driver, you know. I actually had a very bad experience with one of the drivers once. But so there was no way to tell the other people or the other users, be careful with this company. But the good thing about this, the minicabs, is that they were able to drag different, like you said, like you mentioned, like a person that will have several drivers working for him, and they will have all of them together in one application, you know? Mm-hmm. So now they would have to, I mean, and here in Mexico, it's going to be the same. There are companies that are in the collectives that are going to start putting up the application and this commodity as well of paying with your card. I think this is the second thing. If I would have to say, I would say first the system to rate the people, and second the ability to pay with a card. You know, I think especially in Mexico, there is an issue again of security talking about your personal. I mean, I wouldn't give the number of my card to any company just announcing themselves on the internet, you know, because there are like a lot of frauds going on. But I know Uber is a company that I can trust, you know. So I'm not so sure if there's another company putting the application, what is going to be the level of reliance of you giving them your all of your data about your bank account. So I think what makes Uber special is that internationally has a recognition, no, and yeah, the securities they give. And I really hope that the restaurants in London do not close all of them, you know, because it's something that you do traditionally on Sunday. If you don't go for Sunday roast, then you go for a curry, and it's and they have really excellent curries, because as the article says, there's people that are authentically from Bangladesh or from India, and they are excellent cookers, and I mean it would be really a shame if that would have to stop for having an Uber. Or maybe they can come up with a new company and give you curry while you ride or something.
Well, my curry doesn't happen on Sundays. It happens on Thursdays when a mom who is at my son's school and is also from India cooks all week. And then on Thursdays is when she gives out her orders for people who've ordered her dishes. So have to work in the restaurant. She's her own sharing economy. For all I know, she's driving for Uber at night, right?
Yeah.
She's got all that spare time.
Actually, what you see is there are sharing economy apps coming up. The things like Feastly and Eatwith are two examples that are actually on-demand food services. They're basically a restaurant app that you, let's say you do want curry. And for me, I don't know anyone that makes good curry personally, so I don't have access to that. But I simply get on the app and I look around and see who's willing to cook for me. Sometimes at their house, sometimes they'll come to my house. But you are seeing the sharing economy. You know, it isn't just Uber that's going to be disrupting these curry houses, but probably here in the near future, all sorts of apps and platforms that will be disrupting these curry houses.
Yeah, so on the topic still of competition, Chris, Sidecar's gone as of the end of last year. So we've got Lyft, Uber, anybody else you can think of?
Lyft and Uber are really the biggest. There's an app called Halo that I believe is more or less an Uber-esque type app for taxis. And then you have some small regional ones. I can't remember the name of it, but there's one that was started here in D.C. at a tech incubator in downtown D.C. That is trying to be the Uber just for D.C. But what you're really seeing right now is just the two, Uber and Lyft for the most part, battling it out. And you've seen others. HomeJoy is an example of a platform that grew fast and grew somewhat large and then closed up shop given all of the regulatory uncertainty. And they were also, I think, under threat of a class action lawsuit. So this is a very disruptive industry, but also there's a lot of churn within the industry, just like most of the tech sector.
Right. Chris, on the sidecar argument, I was actually going to bring that up because whenever I go into a Lyft and I try never to use Uber, but whenever I go into a Lyft driver and I or sidecar, I ask them, you know, which do you prefer? And I heard a lot of sidecar drivers say that they did prefer driving for sidecar because sidecar really treated them more like independent contractors and gave them more control over, you know, the sidecar drivers could set the price. They could had much more control over whether they picked up a ride or when they pick up a ride. And I wonder, I guess, what your opinion is on sidecar shutting down. Is that a symptomatic of companies that are maybe giving their drivers too much freedom and the Uber or Lyft model is better suited for that? Or is it just the sort of the name recognition and the dollars behind Uber and Lyft that have really pushed the other people out of the market?
Yeah, it might be some of that. I also think there's something, you know, not to get too technical, what economists would call network effects. The idea being that it's better to be on the platform with more people rather than less people. So there is an advantage to being bigger. You know, for example, think of how much fun Facebook would be if you were the only user, or if it was just you and four people. It wouldn't be that fun. It's basically basically a group text, and everyone seems to universally despise a group text. There's an advantage to consumers to being on the platform that has more drivers, and there's an advantage for drivers to being on the platform that has more consumers. So the larger companies certainly do have an inherent advantage over the small upstarts. You know, the ones trying to enter and disrupt this market, even as it's disrupting other markets.
Okay, let's talk for a moment. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, we can move on. That's fine.
No, I think that, what I was going to ask you, Emery, first of all, I wanted to pick up on something you said a moment ago. Why do you not drive with Uber?
Oh, they've had
ride with Uber.
They've had some privacy guffaws in the past. You know, calling the map that all of the Uber operators have access to God mode is a little disheartening. And, of course, the kerfuffles last year, maybe it was the year before that, with the CEO had basically been using Uber to aggressively get dirt on reporters that were sort of poo-pooing on Uber. And just sort of the general – it's – I mean, again, you know, I love Lyft. I love the idea of Uber. The idea, you know, the idea of a ride-sharing platform is I don't think anyone's arguing that it's not a value-added experience or service, but it's the way they're doing it that, you know, I think can draw some well-deserved ire. So I try not to use Uber just because I don't really like the way that they're doing this. And the CEO of Lyft has a more sort of environmentalist utopian idea, and I can get behind that. And in San Diego, I'm lucky enough that there's a lot of drivers for all of the services. So I can usually choose Uber or Lyft or whatever is most available.
Am I right that Lyft is the one that puts mustaches on the cars?
Yeah, Lyft is the pink mustaches. They've rolled back from that. Yeah. They used to have Lyft was really on the community idea, where they made you sit in the front seat and they made you like fist bump as opposed to shake hands, because they were all about the whatever techie community stuff. I don't really get by for that. I like to sit in the back seat on my Lyfts, but yeah, it's basically the same service, but with better business practices.
Do you think Emery, Lyft is a... just a follow up for Emery real quick. Do you think that there is an opportunity, we've seen Sidecar go, for a company to come into this space? You were questioning Chris as to whether autonomy for the drivers was a factor in Sidecar's demise, but what do you think that someone could add to this space that's not there now that could either help the drivers or the riders or both?
I don't know. That's a tough question. I have really enjoyed the some of the things that Lyft has been implementing in the past year or so with the they've made it really easy to do a carpooling system, or where your fee is something like less than half if you just agree to like wait 2 minutes longer and get picked up alongside someone else. Uber was really sort of pushing for that exclusive Uber X, Uber helicopter, Uber black limousine, Uber I'm better than you kind of attitude. And I think that Lyft is much more on the, this is a ride sharing. The idea long term is to, you know, have less cars on the streets, make some money while we're doing it. And, you know, I can get behind that message a little bit better. You know, those are questions for Lyft's team, though. I'm sure that they, I'm sure they've got a lot of smart people trying to figure out how they could iterate and improve. But make it cheaper for us would be great.
Right. You don't need the black Escalade, you're saying.
Yeah.
Sorry, Chris, what were you going to add?
No, I was just going to say, I do think Lyft has tried to target the quirkier audience or the quirkier consumers. Even following them on Twitter, you see the things that they're retweeting and the tweets that they're responding to and all of this. They're trying to make it much, much more fun and less corporate looking than, let's say, Uber, which is very sleek. And they're all about, you know, the just being this sort of giant ride-sharing behemoth, where Lyft is somehow, even though it has its own, you know, tens of billions of dollar valuation, has somehow been able to retain this sort of public persona of being a small community-based upstart, which I do think is interesting. And again, I think back to the regulatory questions. Even as Emery says, you know, I choose Lyft over Uber because I feel like Lyft takes better care of my information and protects me better. These companies have a strong incentive to be the best version of themselves that they can, not because only the fact that they may lose a few, but they could lose many, many riders and many drivers as well. So I think what's happening here is you have a hyper competitive market that's showing that the interconnectivity also is Anna said, is every time anyone has a bad situation, they can give a 1-star rating and give instant feedback to the companies, that these companies have both the capabilities and the strong incentive to make this the best, most consumer friendly environment that they can.
Okay, let's talk about the free market aspect of Uber, specifically the flack that it takes on the consumer side over its surge pricing, and then the flack that it takes from its drivers over the fact that it will cut prices and make drivers charge less when they think that that's going to stimulate people in downtimes like now, post holidays, cold weather, that kind of thing. What do you think about those strategies that Uber's pursuing, Chris? What do you think regulators think about those strategies?
Yeah, so let's tackle them each separately, because I think there's a slightly different story for both of them. I think the surge pricing story is an interesting one, and it really gets to the bottom of what prices really are all about. And typically, like you said, around the holidays, you hear this, like New Year's Eve, you heard people were paying like 10 times surge pricing. Essentially what that is doing is that's that's both signaling to consumers saying, hey, there aren't a lot of Ubers around here, so the people that will get the Ubers are the ones who are willing to pay the most. But then it's also signaling to drivers that say, hey, there's a ton of demand in this area. Drivers are notified when there's surge pricing, and it's, why don't you guys go this way as opposed to the other way and pick up some driver or pick up some riders. So it's really trying to signal and incentivize people to match both supply and demand. I think one thing that people miss in this is that there are a lot of other things that that we buy on a somewhat regular basis, some more regular than others, that are more or less surge-based pricing or dynamic pricing. You have things like you walk into a seafood store or a seafood restaurant and you see that lobster is charged on market price. They don't have a price there. It's market price because it's based on how much lobster they have available and how many people are requesting it. They will raise the price accordingly. Same thing with airline tickets, right? The more people wanting an airline ticket on the more popular routes, the fewer seats available, the higher the price goes. So this is a way that markets sort out supply and demand. And you know, there are other ways that you could do this, right? This is what a cab line is all about. A cab line is just queuing in a different way that everyone is wants a ride, and the drivers cannot charge more because the price of a cab is set at the same price for everyone at all times. So what do? They make you get in a cab line and stand in line. So in essence, instead of being the one most willing to pay 10 times what you normally would pay, you have to be the person who's most willing to wait 10 times the amount of time you would normally have to wait. So I think this is just a different way that markets arrange resources in response to both supply and demand. So that's in a nutshell, I think, what surge pricing is all about. I also think surge pricing is a failure of Uber's app to connect riders and drivers. I don't think Uber wants to surge price. They get a lot of it's a PR blunder every time Uber surge prices. Lyft does surge pricing as well, I think, but they do it slightly differently so they don't ever get the type of flack that Uber does. But I don't think they want surge pricing because the whole point of raising the price is to get people to not chase after that product until the price lowers back down to your willingness to pay. Now with the capping, the other part, the capping, how much a driver can charge, and then lowering that amount within the system and saying, let's say we're reducing fares 10% across the board in a particular city because we don't think people will, you know, request cars as much if it was 10% higher, for example. Mm-hmm. I think that's also another way to signal to people to come get rides. So if a driver, for example, could charge $10 and get one ride or charge $8 and get two rides, my guess is that, you know, the driver is better off with $16 as opposed to $10. Now that's a choice for the driver to make. And maybe this, again, like Sidecar, is another opportunity for a new app or a new platform to jump in and say, actually, we're going to go with complete open transparent pricing dictated by each individual driver. So you could match up that way. But as Uber and Lyft currently do it, they set the prices more or less, and they set the amount that they take as their commission. And what they're really trying to do is incentivize people to get into the platform. So you think they typically do it during the lowest demand parts of the year. So when people are less apt to request rides, they try to make it easier for people to request rides. And I think that's really what the decreasing fares is about. It's not so much trying to take anything from drivers, although there's no reason to think that Uber would want to do that because then they'd all just become Lyft drivers or vice versa. So I think a lot of this is really the market and trying to use prices to sort out supply and demand.
I think you just answered my earlier question to Emery about something that someone could try. I don't know that if anybody's trying this yet, but in your answer there was the kernel of an idea of transparent pricing and maybe a sort of bid response model where someone offers you a ride for X dollars and you say, no, that's too much, but I'll pay you 80% of that and you have a virtual handshake and you get a ride. I don't know if anyone's pursuing that.
Or you could imagine it in some sort of Tinder-esque kind of way where mm-hmm. I say I want a ride for this amount, and on the other side are all of the drivers that said I will drive for this amount, and we've both self-selected independently. Mm-hmm. And when you have a match, then boom, you're paired mm-hmm. on the app. There are ways that right. an entrepreneur could come about doing this, and I think it's important, especially as we've just sat here in the past minute and come up with two different sort of business plans for a new ride sharing app, mm-hmm. that the more restrictive the regulations are at this point, especially as young as the industry is, the greater likelihood it is that it will be more difficult for an entrepreneur to step in and disrupt the Ubers and Lyfts of the world. For example, the transportation network company regulations here in Virginia require a $100,000 licensing fee just to be a TNC or a ride sharing company here in Virginia. And that's a high price for, let's say, a small startup or a single entrepreneur to pay to simply test their app and say, is this on a small basis a viable product in the market? It's really created a barrier to entry that you can mark my words here. I don't think the next great ride sharing app, as long as this licensing fee is in place in Virginia, is going to come out of Virginia. It's going to come out somewhere else where it's easier. The barriers to entry are lower for an entrepreneur to jump in that market.
All right. Well, we've spent a lot of time on Uber. We could spend the whole show on Uber, but we've got other things to talk about. I'll just go around and ask you all if you have any final comments or thoughts. Anna, any thoughts on Uber's pricing restraints on drivers, raising prices during surge times, or anything else as we wrap up this part of our discussion?
I just don't know if it's working in other cities as well, but I know that they have now a new service, Uber Pool, where you can share your ride with other person, and immediately, even if another person doesn't jump on your ride, it discounts 20% of the normal price. So I think they are already doing like an effort of lowering the prices, at least in mm-hmm. the city, but. Yeah, I think like Christopher pointed out, it's a fair thing to do in a supply demand environment, and it is optional also to the users not to go with this company, but rather choose another one.
Right. The one thing that occurs to me people could do as well is, and I don't know if these exist or not yet, but. I think they will if they don't already, is apps that compare. You could get a ride here from Uber for this amount of money, from Lyft for this amount of money, or mm-hmm. other alternatives that might be available. Emery, any last thoughts?
Yeah, I have to say I love the idea of the Tinder swipe right to get a ride at this fare. I think that's awesome. I mean, I will say that when I think the best thing about Sidecar was that it did exactly what you're implying, Denise, and that mm-hmm. it told you exactly how much the fare was going to be before you even got in the car. And, that element of predictability, I think, was really, really a great selling point. And that's one of the problems with Uber and Lyft. Lyft, I think, offers an estimate, but Uber especially, you get in the car, it'll tell you that there's surge pricing, but you don't really know when you say, I'm agreeing to the 2.5x surge pricing, that you're actually paying for a $400, car ride at 2 a.m. My problem with a surge pricing, though, is I think that it sort of cuts against the idea that, that they are filling the gap where, people need it. Especially I've heard, saying that, you shouldn't drive drunk. You should take an Uber at 2 a.m., which is great, except that at every that's really obviously awesome. But mm-hmm. at 2 a.m. on the dot every night, not that I'm out partying at 2 a.m., but I've heard from my classmates and peers that at 2 a.m. every night, the surge pricing kicks in. And it's not just on New Year's Eve, which is, a huge drunk driving night, but it's basically every night. And so, mm-hmm. I don't know. I understand the supply and demand argument. I we're talking about it in the chat that I do think that there's a place for them to sort of respect the customer and, I don't know. I can see both sides of the argument, but yeah, I think we should move on.
Yeah, I mean, lawmakers definitely are looking hard at this economy and wondering how and whether they should step in. I know the head of the FTC is curious and keeping a close eye, but I don't know that we're going to see anything immediately forthcoming. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, especially not out of the FTC. They've seemed to signal that their approach here is to take a wait and see approach, which is mm-hmm. to let the market play out, to let problems may arise, and then when they do, that's when they'll step in and regulate. So I think that's probably the approach that will work best in a highly innovative sector like the sharing economy, where things are changing day to day, where most of the just one final point, most of these TNC regulations at a state level are based on a driver model. That is, all of the regulations are written as if your car is driven by a human being. Now, Emery and I were talking before the show about how we can't wait for driverless cars. Now, once, you know, Uber and Lyft and all of these companies roll out their autonomous vehicles, and we all know that they're investing in them heavily right now, all the regulations and laws are going to have to be rewritten. So I think taking a flexible approach to this industry and regulating on the margins when problems arise is probably the best way to allow the best case scenarios to play out in this space.
Yeah, I guess the moral of that story is don't give up your curry making skills. You may need them again later when you're not driving. All right. Well, I think someone's at the door. Maybe? Oh, yeah. Someone's at the door. And look. I can see it on my phone. Wow. It's ringing on my phone. How does that work? Well, this is how it works. You answer. And look here, if I hold it up, if I don't get the glare from the screen, if I hold up my Ring doorbell here and my phone, you should be seeing my computer monitor, because that's what the Ring doorbell is seeing. And that, and I could talk to, if I push the talk button here on my phone, which can see what the Ring is seeing, I could talk to myself. That doesn't work so well when there's no one at the door. But what I'm holding here is a really cool, speaking of disruptive devices, creative devices filling a need that maybe you didn't know you had. This is a Ring video doorbell, which I mentioned on the show last week. My New Year's resolution was to get this thing set up and running, which I did last night. Ooh, I'm holding it upside down. That's not good. I did last night in a matter of literally minutes. They're so easy to set up. You download an app to your phone, and all of the equipment that you need to set up this doorbell and get it operating on your front door is included in the box. You can mount it any number of ways. You can mount it to concrete, and they provide you with literally a drill bit, which I didn't have to get out, so it's still stuck in the box here. But they provide you, if you're installing on wood, they provide you with a screwdriver and screws, a little drill bit and molly bolts if you need to drill through something a little harder. And they have very nice videos that walk you through the whole installation process. And once it's in, you're actually video chatting with whoever's at your door when it rings. Instead of answering your door physically, you can pick up your phone, swipe to the app, and you'll see and be able to speak with the person who's at your front door, which has all kinds of great ramifications, right? It means if someone's delivering a package, you could tell them where to leave it. You can tell your friends coming over for dinner that you ran out to get extra kale. You can, if you see that it's someone who's up to no good, obviously that's a great thing, and you can take some steps to protect yourself. One thing, speaking of just disruptive and changing the way people do things, when you're using a Ring video doorbell, you can answer your doorbell from anywhere. So people are going to need to think about changing their habits a little bit and, you know, taking in the stranger at the door and deciding whether or not to tell that person that they're not home. That's something you should certainly bear in mind. It's not that creates any greater security risk, because everything that the Ring does it, all the video that it takes is recorded. So if there's someone at your door who shouldn't be there, you've told them that you're not home, and then they do something bad, that's all, you know, there, you're going to have some nice evidence for law enforcement to help you out there. But I do think
does that have a, does that like, you know, lock the door as well, or is it just a door, like a doorbell?
It is just a doorbell. No, it doesn't have any, connection to your lock at all. It can replace your existing doorbell. You can wire it into your existing doorbell wiring, or as I did, I'm going to put it next to our existing doorbell.
Yeah, it looks like a good option for apartment renters.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's a really good option for apartment renters. I'm one who's known to think a few months down the road as far as wanting to lay aside gifts for people. So I have them ready when they, when the occasion rolls around, and I'm thinking this is a great gift for a grad, whether they're going out, into their own apartment, or even, you know, someone who's just starting school. How boss are you if you have this outside your dorm room and you can see who's dropping by to order pizza with you? I just think, they're really cool on any number of fronts. Security, of course, being first and foremost, so that you can see who's at the door. There's also advanced motion detection in this thing. You can fine tune the motion detection so that it is exactly in the range around the doorbell, wherever you've mounted it, where you have it record whoever walks in front of it. So even if someone doesn't ring the doorbell, you're going to see who's lurking around your front door. You can talk to delivery people. You can keep an eye on your package. If someone tries to mess with the doorbell, you'll get an instant alert and HD video of the whole thing. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. As I experienced last night, the installation could not be easier. The setup is literally, you know, you just connect it to your Wi-Fi network and basically you're off and running. Oh, I should mention too, that it, you can either, if you wire it into your existing doorbell wiring, I believe that powers the thing. But if you don't, if you want to mount it separately like I did, it's battery operated, and that does not mean you're constantly putting double A's in there. It has a little USB charger. So when it is out of battery, you just bring it inside and charge it for a little while, and it's good to go again. It literally took minutes to install. It works with either your current wiring or its built-in rechargeable battery. And it's really going to put your mind at ease and protect your home probably give you a few moments of fun too, or the gift recipient of your choice would definitely have some fun with it, I think. Time Magazine and USA Today named it one of their top 10 gadgets of 2015. So you should check it out. To do that, you'll go to ring.com/twill, T-W-I-L, and you're going to get free expedited FedEx shipping when you do that. That's ring.com/twill. With Ring, you're always home. Thank you so much, Ring, for your support of This Week in Law. Let's move on to an industry that has some regulation that is different than the ride-sharing industry we've been discussing, namely the telecommunications and data delivery business in the wake of the recently enacted net neutrality rules. T-Mobile seems poised to be the first company to really have a big test of what's going to be permitted under the new net neutrality rules and what's not. And I don't know if you've been watching TV lately, but they've had a big push in ads for their Binge On service that allows users to have certain video activities exempted from their monthly data cap on their T-Mobile account. So that is called zero rating, and that is controversial from a net neutrality standpoint in its own right. T-Mobile's plan seems designed to try to not run afoul of the net neutrality rules, as they are not charging their preferred video folks, the people who are going to come in and not be counted as within the data cap. Those people aren't charged. And as I understand it, anybody at this network, any other video distribution channel, you just have to jump through the hoops with T-Mobile and you're going to be under that umbrella. It has to do with technical specifications rather than any sort of economic arrangement between you and T-Mobile. However, the other aspect of this is to make it all work, they apparently are going to throttle back other video and deliver lower quality video. EFF is concerned that that hasn't been adequately disclosed to consumers. They really don't know that what's being touted as optimized video for certain channels is really just throttled back video for everyone else. Chris, have you been paying attention to this? And what do you think about the whole arrangement?
Only slightly. I haven't been following it specifically other than the tweet from the T-Mobile, the video tweet he put out that sort of caught my attention in my newsfeed. But it does seem to be interesting. Interesting to me is that, you know, we're not even 1 year out of the net neutrality, the passage of net neutrality, and all of that debate being settled, and now all of a sudden here come all sorts of debates over whether or not you can optimize and throttle and zero rating, and is it in customers' best interest or not in their best interest? I think it really just shows again sort of the differences of opinion over this issue in the industry, and perhaps the inability of the regulations themselves to be clearly delineated, but then also flexible to allow for companies to experiment like this.
Okay, Emery, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think John needs a lesson in the Streisand effect. I mean, you know, this is something that T-Mobile talked about a year ago, and they, during their you know, statement when they were making it, they did say that, oh, we'll apply the binge on optimization to all third-party videos, not even just the ones that T-Mobile has a contract with, which I think that for people that were paying attention to that, it really sent up a red flag that, well, this is probably just going to be throttling in the end anyways. And that's essentially what it turns out to be. I think the problem is that T-Mobile has effectively, you sign into binge on as a program that ostensibly optimizes videos and makes it available for you to stream them without counting against your, you know, allotment, but it throttles all video. So if you have a T-Mobile smartphone with a nice, very pretty 5-inch screen and it's, you know, super high res and you want to watch Netflix, well, sorry, you can't. If you want to watch Twit on high – in HD at least. If you want to watch Netflix on HD, if you want to watch this stream in HD, you can't. It's going to be throttled back. You know, that's not that – I mean, I don't know. It's certainly controversial in certain circles, but the fact that John came out and, you know, dropped an F-bomb and, you know, saying like, who the F are you, Twit – or EFF, was really not a good idea. I mean, we all liked John's sort of bombastic character a lot more when he was just lashing out at telecom giants. When you start going after the nonprofit advocacy group, I mean, you're – you know, it's not a good fight to pick on Twitter. So yeah, I won't be signing up for T-Mobile's Binge On program. It sounds like in theory it could be a way for companies to deal with mobile data. But I think that it sounds like it does run afoul of some of the net neutrality rules that were set last year. So
yeah,
can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
So do the Binge On program, will it be slowing down everyone's videos or when you opt in exchange for zero rating, that data usage, all of your videos are then, slowed down? How do you know exactly the details of how the program is going to operate in reality?
I've read, it sounds like, the preferred folks who are exempted from your data cap are not going to be throttled, and that everyone else is. Although maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe everything is throttled and that's how they're pulling it off.
I think it's just video content. It's some technical way of whenever there's video playing, it will automatically throttle it down if you're on binge on. Now it's not what they had said, and what I think was implied, is that they have a deal with YouTube and Netflix and these major – well, actually, they said that they don't have a deal with YouTube, but they do have one with Netflix that was allowing them to optimize. And I think that by saying the word optimize, I mean that is dishonest, because there's no real optimization. That's what the EFF was having an issue with, is that there's no optimization. It's just, oh, we see you're playing video. We'll throttle that down a bit now. And, you know, to your question, Christopher, I don't think that it applies to people that are not opted into the Binge On program. So I don't think all of T-Mobile users are suffering this. But I do think that anyone that has signed into Binge On is seeing that it's, you know, affecting all of their videos across the board.
Right. Anna, do you see any difficulties with this kind of arrangement from a creator's standpoint? Obviously, someone who's going to the trouble of putting things out in HD video is are going to want it delivered that way. Do you think that there's any kind of recourse that creators might have against T-Mobile for this kind of plan?
Definitely. I think the way telecommunications is working is changing over the last years, and it's and I think I really wonder, like, if in 10 years from now there's going to be any TV broadcasting at all. And I think, I mean, this is the way exactly how, well, creative people and entrepreneurs and everyone is just making themselves known through the free ways they can, I mean, by YouTube, by all of the tools that we have now to mm-hmm. to stream and to stream what we want to share with the world, no? And I think it sounds to me a little bit like the companies haven't found a way to deal with that, to give like the whole liberty, freedom, for entrepreneurs and from creative people, but definitely there needs to be some sort of regulation or something that can handle both approaches. I don't know, like the from on one side, from the big TV broadcasting, not TV only, not TV, I'm sorry, T-Mobile goes have like a very big scope. But the big companies and like the interest of all the rest of the people, actually.
Mm-hmm. Anna, you do a lot of traveling throughout the world. I'm wondering how you manage your data usage. For those of us in the U.S. who are locked in with a company like AT&T or Verizon, we're not locked in, but we use them. Traveling becomes quite an expensive proposition, especially if you plan to use data abroad. Have you found a good way to manage that? And is it different when your carrier is outside the US?
Yes, definitely. I mean, in the UK, I don't want it to make it sound like an advertisement, but I think there are like very good options for you to be traveling. Like you can have a very good network. And when I was living in the UK, I would travel to the US, and it was like really cheap, and the network was amazing, and I was really happy with it. But then I could not take that network to Mexico, and then here I had to hire a new one, and mm-hmm. I think it's the same, and unfortunately it's the same as in the US, that they are very expensive prices if you want to go abroad, and it's even worse because then it's just one company, not two or three, it's just one company that has the monopoly, and I think all over Latin America. So, and there you go. Like definitely, what I had to do, what people have to do when they are in Mexico and they are traveling abroad, you have to buy another. You have to have an unlocked device, mm-hmm. so you are able to hire another company wherever you are.
Right. I'm going to give a try to something that I stumbled on a while ago and just made note of, and it looked interesting. That's sort of disrupting its business model is to disrupt the exorbitant data roaming prices that get charged when you leave the US, and it's a little mobile hotspot that you pay a flat fee for unlimited data in. I think they cover 175 countries. Soon I will give that a try. I'll let you folks know how that works.
I did just get back from Italy, and it was atrocious internet across the board. Every single place I was in had really, really bad internet. So it's a wonderful city or a wonderful country otherwise. But from what I hear, whether you're going actually getting like your internet from the telecoms at your house or if you're in a SIM card system, it's not very good. So anecdotal.
And that's the thing. I don't know how is it going to be later because, you know, I don't know, in London, in the tube, you have Wi-Fi for free. So, and I heard also from Singapore, I haven't been there yet, but I heard that in Singapore, there's Wi-Fi everywhere. So I don't know if it's a matter of like the companies not letting the government giving this free Wi-Fi to everyone, or what is it that they are not... Why is it what is different from the UK and Singapore and the rest of the countries that they are able to do it? I mean, in Mexico, maybe it's clear, isn't it? We don't have the money, probably.
Right. Let's do a couple of copyright stories as we get down toward the end of the show here and examine that area of the law. It's almost the end of January, and actually it's only January 15th, so mid-January. Let's not age our month before it's prime here. But, of course, with the beginning of each new year, new items come into the public domain as things fall out of copyright. Public Domain Day, it is known as. However, in the U.S., we don't have a whole lot to celebrate. Emery, can you bring us up to speed as to what happened in other countries on Public Domain Day and why here in the U.S. we're still unable to access these kinds of things?
Well, I've got to say Cory Doctorow has some excellent, excellent coverage of it on his blog, Boing Boing. But essentially every year on Public Domain Day, some academics publish a list of works that would be going into the public domain in America had we the pre-1978 copyright laws. So in 1978, the copyright laws were extended to essentially make sure that nothing ever enters the public domain. So the next year that we're going to actually get works entering the public domain isn't until 2036. And it's a real shame. I mean, I think I'm trying to pull up the list here. But we, you know, there's works by T.S. Eliot, The Manchurian Candidate. I mean, it's everything from science fiction to, you know, everything under the sun would be in some works that writers and creators would be able to access and use that unfortunately we can't. So it's a real shame. And I think that Corey's article is a really heartfelt sort of a lamentation of that. So I recommend anyone to check that out. Yeah, last year, for example, I've got it here. We lost we could have had Starship Troopers, The Manchurian Candidate, The Tin Drum, Goldfinger, The Elements of Style. All of these books that are really great pieces of literature could have entered into the public domain to allow anyone to work on them, to build off of them, to make their own remixes of. And it's a real shame that we don't have that. And it, we would have had we just had the pre-1978 copyright rules.
Right. And we should clarify that we're talking about things that go into public domain by operation of law without anybody having to take any further steps. They're just a certain age and then they would enter the public domain. It is possible to create works and donate them to the public domain. It's not as straightforward as you might think, but it can be done. And so we're talking about things that would just sort of automatically become available and do in other countries. Two of those things, in a strange twist of ironic fate, that did go into the public domain, although there is some controversy about the Anne Frank diary and yeah. It's only the Dutch version of the diary, but that work is entering the public domain as of this year. And
I think that's actually really interesting. So yeah. The story about Anne Frank's diary entering the public domain. So the controversy is that Anne Frank's father or uncle, sorry, the version that we're all familiar with is a highly edited and compiled version of her diary. According to the copyright owners of the according to the current copyright owners, they say that the version that we're accustomed to is heavily edited, that her uncle had taken pieces together and put them together into a cohesive, readable diary. I've also heard that, you know, for example, her own sexual explorations were, you know, redacted from the version that we've all read. So when you read on the article that Anne Frank's diary has entered the public domain, the original Dutch version is now in the public domain, but the edited version that we're accustomed to has not. Now, I kind of have some sympathy for that argument as someone that likes mashups and likes fair use and, you know, that whole style or that whole side of the content creation process. You know, their argument that the work that her uncle compiled should deserve its own copyright, I think that that has some merit. I think that's an argument that is probably missed in the headlines. That, you know, we're not talking about Anne Frank's original diary. We're talking about the compiled and edited version. I think it's great, though, that the original untranslated text is now available online.
Although from what you're saying, it may require a more PG-13 kind of rating. I think we'll...
That's history for you.
That's right. I think that will make our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of the show. Really, Miss Frank. In honor of that. And we'll put another phrase in the show before we wrap up here. We put these phrases in the show in case you are listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit in your field. You can demonstrate to your oversight body that you have actually watched or listened by knowing the phrases that are randomly inserted into the show. If you need more information about that, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and there is more information there for you. Anna, any thoughts about items coming into the public domain this year? Oh, I forgot to just close out the mention of Anne Frank's diary by mentioning that many are glad that at least the Dutch version is coming into the public domain this year, because Mein Kampf has also come into the public domain this year. And as I understand it, has been selling well. It's also the first year it's been available for sale in Germany, I believe, and that it's been selling well, which is culturally interesting, I suppose. Anna, can you add anything to... Sorry?
Sorry, I think that the version of Mein Kampf that was released is also a heavily annotated version.
Yes.
Again, for like weird copyright reasons, I think that they're hoping that the copyright on this one will last 70 years and discourage the market for the original unannotated edition of Mein Kampf. But really, it's a 2,000-page, very boring, badly written book. So, you know.
Yes. Anna, what can you add to our public domain discussion here?
Well, I think in general, I think public domain, it's the, I mean, there has been like a lot of issues. Like you said, if I create something today, it wouldn't be part of the public domain immediately. But it will have to wait until the author dies, and then the years of the protection of the place. But I think... it depends on the piece of work, really. I think maybe some of the works of the creations should be available sooner. But I think this will be really difficult to decide in general. But my personal opinion is that some of the work should be available sooner than others. However, I recognize that this is really difficult to decide, and that's why it had to be standardized. In regards to what the Anne Frank's diary, the foundation, I think it's the it's a charity entity, the one that is fighting for the edition to be recognized, and then it's in contraposition with the with the romanticism again, among the story, you know, like we really thought that what we were reading was like the words of this little girl that was living through this during this difficult time, and I think, I mean, so then they are saying that the edition really affected the creativity of the little girl, and we all have been fooled by when we read it, you know, thinking that it was directly taken from her diary, although now. Well, a lot of people put their diaries up on Facebook and make it available for everyone to see it now. So, that's what I would have to say for now.
I've got one thing Chris. I wanted to add, actually, that I wanted to ask, I guess, both Chris and Anna on their opinions, is that something that we forgot to say is that with the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this is really, you know, Public Domain Day is going to shift and be a, remembrance that not just in America, but in all these other countries that are part of the TPP, they're going to have the same copyright laws as we do, pushing the same, you know, making it basically impossible for works to enter into the public domain. So I, you know, on the regulatory front and on the international sort of ADR IP front that I know Anna has worked with, I'd love to hear our guests' opinions on that.
Well, I think I actually haven't had the chance to see the IP part of the TPP. I wonder whether they took it from WikiLeaks or where is it available? Because actually in Mexico, there is like a higher standard. Mexico is also part of the TPP. Mm. And we have even 100 years after the author died. So it's pushing the boundaries even a little bit further. And I think like if the rule is as the article says, that would mean that we will reduce 30 years, which I think it's better in this case, no? But what the article says is also that in Canada at the moment is like 50 years. And then they will push the boundaries higher there will not be any public domain release until 2036 for another 20 years. I think, like I said again, it really depends on who has who owns the patrimonial rights at this moment. No, like why would it be important to keep it for that long? It is clear that Disney really wants that, no? and other big companies, but for other authors, I mean, it would be I don't know. For me, the ideal thing would be to have a difference between the amount of time that it will have protection after the author dies. I don't know.
Chris, any public domain thoughts for us?
Yeah, I guess my first point on the public domain issues would be we've sort of lost the sight of what copyright, as a society, we sort of lost sight of what the purpose of copyright was in the first place, and that was protecting intellectual property as an incentive for people to create things. And now we've gotten to a point where copyright is simply a way by which people who have already created things, let's say some 70 or 80 years ago, and in the example that Anna just gave of Disney is perfect, that we're simply using it to protect large businesses and large corporations from their copyrights expiring. I also think that something like the TPP creating standards for other countries that had lax or more open copyright laws is an issue where you actually saw ideological agreement between free marketeers and folks like George Stiglitz, where everybody realized that the TPP was really just being used in many ways to take a corporate protectionist stance on something like copyright, where again I think we've really lost sight of copyright as an incentive. That is, you know, from the economics point of view, it was an incentive to create things, and it's gone from incentive to excess. So,
but I think putting the Disney example aside, there are also other good examples. I know that everything that is related to Peter Pan exploitation rights goes directly to a children's hospital in London, because the author left the exploitation rights to that hospital, which I think is like a very laudable thing to do. Also, Bob Marley with the song "No Woman, No Cry" goes to a foundation that helps people that live on the streets in Jamaica. So it's such a weird thing to say, but like if it's for a good heart goal, you know. I don't know what this Anne Frank Fonds Charitable Foundation does as well. But I mean, I think that it's very different from just exploding the market.
That's true, and I could definitely see some countries deciding to take a different approach if that's the case. I don't know how you implement sort of a case by case review of whether something should be in the public domain or not. But that is an excellent point. We were laughing before the show because the monkey selfie is in the news again, and it may continue to be in the news for some time based on comments from the judge in the case here that was recently decided. We mentioned on the show a while ago when it was filed that PETA had filed, PETA, the Protection of Animals, Persons for Protection of Animals. I'm not sure what the acronym stands for. However, you know what they do. Here we go. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is what PETA stands for. And no, we're not talking about a Hunger Games character. But what they have done, and they've done this in not just this lawsuit, is from time to time they will sue on behalf of an animal and try and get a court to establish animal rights. And that is what they did in the monkey selfie case. They sued on behalf of Naruto the macaque, who borrowed photographer David Slater's camera and took a wonderful picture of himself. I think Naruto is a he. And PETA decided that Naruto's rights were being infringed, that since Naruto was the photographer, Naruto owned the copyright, any commercial exploitation of this work should have resulted in royalties or payment to Naruto, was infringement of Naruto's rights. And that was what the lawsuit was all about, despite the fact that the Copyright Office came out and made a statement that animals cannot own copyrights. The judge in this case, and this is why I don't think the case might go away, actually said this is an issue for Congress and the president. If they think animals should have the right of copyright, they're free, I think, under the Constitution to do that. But the judge decided he was not free. So once again, we get to put the wonderful monkey selfie image on our program, and I'm sorry, Naruto, but you're out of luck as far as having anyone infringe. Chris, any thoughts on this?
Not anything in particular, other than it seems a little strange. Mickey Mouse is protected fiercely by copyright, but Naruto is left out in the cold. So I guess this is an issue, maybe perhaps for Congress to take up. And until then, it looks like he will be throwing stones at the courthouse wall.
Right. And of course, PETA was not going to keep the money. It was going to use the money for good purposes on Naruto's behalf. Emery, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I was saying before the show that I couldn't believe this was still a story, but you know, it does have me thinking. I kind of wish that we had someone that has dealt with some animal cruelty, trials in the past, because I don't know. I mean, that is an interesting thing. Is this a political question? Is it up to Congress and the president to say that animals have human rights, or is that something that a judge should be saying? I'm not entirely clear, but it looks like the story still has legs. So.
What would be interesting though is if indeed it was found that that Naruto had a copyright in his image, what would that do to a large operation like SeaWorld, who has more or less just profited off of various pictures of killer whales for some 40 years or however long they've been around? Is that it would really change the way in which a lot of companies, National Geographic, for example, would I guess have to get permission to use every wildlife picture that they ever put in their magazine.
Would that be a name and likeness issue or a copyright issue, right? I mean, the camera taker would have the right to the copyright of that photo, but
certainly. Yeah. I just mean intellectual property in general. I mean, it's a sticky wicket, especially when it comes to something like this.
Right.
Someone in this chat said, Toad Sloth said, if corporations are people, then that monkey is naturalized. I kind of like that.
I think we have to make the IP sticky wicket our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Any thoughts, Anna, before we move on?
Well, just to say that I totally agree that it will open like a broader discussion and debate about so many other things, like or even the pets that you have at home. I mean, I have a question of what does PETA have to do with representing this monkey in particular? I mean, who is to say, you know, first of all, and then, I mean, I think that, yeah, I mean, we are losing again the scope of copyright, which is to encourage creation. I mean, so yeah, and innovation and et cetera. And yeah, I mean, having an animal owning an IP right, who is going to measure how much innovation is being encouraged? And, yeah, I think it would be too complicated. Yeah.
I do think this is all interesting to watch too, from the standpoint of artificial intelligence and what sort of rights will be afforded to artificial life forms as they begin to become more of a viable thing. And Siri here is paying attention closely to these discussions. Speaking of phones, let's move on to a final story about music. I find this absolutely fascinating, and I did not know about it. It's been around since 2011 until yesterday, driving home with my son, who had just been he was having a palate cleansing sort of experience. He had just been listening to classical music for an hour, and he said he really needed to just shift gears, and he asked to borrow my phone, which he did. He picked up and he DJ'd our ride home to the tune of his favorite thing to listen to these days, which I hadn't really clued into, and it's called Monster Cat. And I, for a while, and I think he was under a misapprehension too, that it was an artist itself called Monster Cat. No, it turns out what Monster Cat is an independent record label based in Vancouver with a whole host of artists under its umbrella, and a very interesting approach on a couple of fronts. Number one, the deals it does with artists are far different than traditional record industry deals. It does, for example, I think sometimes one-on-one, one track only kinds of arrangements with artists, or maybe they sign up to do more works than that. But the artists wind up keeping control and ownership over far more of their catalog than they otherwise would in a conventional recording deal. Secondly, they have a very, and this is why my son knows about them, they have a very progressive licensing approach. It's not as progressive as donating things to the public domain, but they are trying something new and different with licensing. The reason my son knows about them is they are particularly targeting folks who record videos for YouTube and Twitch and wanting to make their catalog of artists available to that group of people. They are having great success with that. My son knows about them from watching Let's Play videos, where Monster Cat artists are used as the background music for what's going on, or maybe for live streams, I think, in the case of either YouTube or Twitch. But they have a couple of different licensing models that they offer for people who want to reuse Monster Cat artists' works. They have a free model, and they have a paid subscription model. The paid subscription model is $15 roughly a month. And for that, you can make commercial use of their works by using advertising, by profiting from advertising on those platforms. With the other one, with the free one, you can't. You can still use the music, but you're not supposed to also get the ad revenue if you do. And the other kicker there is if you're paying the subscription license, They will exempt you. They will make sure that your channel is not being put in the content ID system. So you're not being content matched to have to deal with the hassle of potentially have your videos taken down. In the free model, that's not the case. You're still going to be in the content ID system. I think if you're in the free model and Monster Cat decides, you know, there's no harm, no foul, they'll still leave your videos up, but you might have the administrative headache of having to jump through a few more hurdles. The other thing I will say about this, having listened to a lot of their catalog on the way home yesterday, is it's great stuff. It's really, really good electronic music. I was really impressed. I was telling my son that some of it sounded like Thievery Corporation to me, and he's like, "What's that?" That's way too old for him to know what it is.
Pinch his little cheeks.
But it's really good stuff, and I think they've hit on something very innovative and interesting here. Emery, I think you took a look at the actual terms of the license when you put that in our discussion points. I did too, and I noticed some confusion there about they seem to be wanting to have that subscription license be for commercial use. I would consider advertising revenue commercial use, but their language in the license is a little bit weird and doesn't really clearly say that you can make commercial use. It does clearly say that you can use ads. So I think redrafting could be in order.
I'm right there with you. I think that it's, you know, I'm very interested in it as, you know, a new business model for a music label. You know, the fact that they're successful and they're making money, you know, more power to them. As far as how revolutionary it is, I'm not sure if I'm on board with that. I took a look at the actual terms, and, you know, I feel free for Anna to correct me if she's taken a look at this as well, but some of the terms don't actually sound that great. So as I understand it, the music subscriber license allows content creators that have the license to reuse any other content creator that is also subscribed to the Monster Cat subscriber license. But the terms of use actually specify that you're not allowed to make commercial use of those songs. So you are allowed, the only thing that you're allowed to use are to reuse that content in order to make YouTube or Twitch videos. And you can then collect 100% of the advertising streams from those videos. But that's it. Mm-hmm. You can't monetize the videos in any other way. And really, you're tied to YouTube and Twitch. Monster Cat, let's be very clear, owns all the rights to the song otherwise. You're just basically granted a license to it. Now, that's not that different from the way the traditional publisher model has worked. You know, the record label owned all the songs before and could control how they are marketed it. But it's a little, I don't know, it rubs me the wrong way when a company comes out with the ethos that they have, that the, you know, they're all about the community, and they put out this manifesto that said that, you know, piracy isn't piracy, it's a celebration of music, which frankly I agree with. But the power dynamic between the record label and the artists is still just as unbalanced, I think. I'm not really clear. What it seems to be is that it's a very good way of building a very tight community of dance music that is tied explicitly to YouTube and Twitch and to the Monster Cat brand. So that's great. You know, that's great that it works in that context for that community. You know, I think that the nature of dance music lends itself more to this type of model than probably any other kind of music, maybe hip hop or electronic, you know, other, you know, more as electronic music gets into every other genre, maybe it's more applicable. But it does sort of worry me that it's tied so completely to these platforms. You know, the artists are really at the mercy of YouTube and Twitch, and they can't take those songs and do anything else with them. So, you know, it's great, but it definitely has some issues with it.
The reaction I had when I read through the actual terms of service is, and I read the manifesto too, which is a wonderful statement of how we think in today's day and age that music is derivative and builds on itself and sharing and mashups and yay. But then when you go through and read those terms, it's like their lawyers didn't get that memo.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there may be maybe the terms are broader than they need to be. And I think that the company, you know, if push came to shove, my guess is that they would say, no, we're not going to sue you for infringement, but who knows?
I certainly hope so. Yeah. I certainly hope so. They seem to be totally capitalizing on the community aspect. I mean, I can see already we've got a couple people in the chat that that obviously like Monster Cat, and you know, the community is great. I worry about companies that sort of create a community of loyal followers that almost certainly haven't actually read the terms of use. You know, we can say that when push comes to shove, they would say, oh, we certainly don't want to sue you. But, right. And according to their contract, they certainly could.
Right. And there's a real danger of that. When this was presented to me and I was listening to all the good music, my son, you know, knowing what I'm interested in, chimed in and said, and you know, all of their music, well, how he put it was, is not under copyright. And I had to explain, under copyright, but it might be licensed.
Their website, the way they present it on their website is, I think it's just misleading. I think that the sound blurbs, the paragraph of FAQs that they have is frankly just not clear about who actually owns the rights. They say things like, oh, you can use the music for free. And that's big caveats there, you know? So again, you know, I am more cynical than I'd like to be about these, disruptive companies. But best of luck. I hope that they turn out not to be evil.
Right. They may have some growing pains around uses that they're okay with and not. And we may see them in the news more in the future for that. But in the meantime, I just wanted to bring it to people's attention. It looks like, first of all, it's a great catalog of music. And secondly, they're trying something new and different, both on the artist side and on the reuse side. Anna, had you heard of this before?
Actually, no, I hadn't heard of, maybe because I'm not too much in dance music, but I think, like Emery was pointing that it creates a very good environment for community, but at the same time, one might wonder why are they restricting this environment or the broadcasting of the music there and just for YouTube and Twitch. I mean, is it because this is the way they can control how to make revenue with the advertisement or another if it would be in another platform, they wouldn't control it, they wouldn't be able to control it? Or I mean, as a platform, it's great to enhance creativity. Obviously, and to share, know other people that like this, but why are they restricting it? I mean, I hope someone could ask them why are they restricting them to these two platforms.
Yep, I think that's a good question. I know they have a 24/7 live stream on Twitch that is, it's, you know, all Monster Cat Radio. They release three new tracks a week. They have 25 compilation albums at this point, and more to come. Chris, any thoughts on this?
Not really. I guess from the way that the website is worded, it seems like they're empowering artists. I know recently I was listening to an interview by James Taylor, who said most of the hits we know of his are ones that he had to fight very long to actually get any money for, because he had signed away the publishing rights to a company when he was 18 years old or something, because he was desperate to record his first song. So if this is in any way a step toward empowering, you know, artists as they get started, it sounds good. But it seems like once you get into the details, and that typically is always where the devil is, that's, you know, it doesn't seem to be as amazing as it sounds at first blush. So I guess it's one of those things you just have to be careful. But is it a marginal step in the right direction, perhaps?
Right.
Yeah, and one thing, sorry to chime in.
I was just going to say one thing we should. And then you. we should make people very aware that you might be lured into thinking that all of this music is freely available for any use, and it's just not. So you need to pay attention to that. And Emery?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, on the empowering users front, it is very, very locked down. And in a way, Chris, it feels almost like sort of an independent contractorization of musicians, because what this record label, and I'm using air quotes around it, record label does is that they only produce a song, or they agree to produce a single for the content creator. So they help that content creator create a single. Now they own all the rights to that song. The content creator is allowed to get 100% of the ad revenue on YouTube and Twitch, and that's it. Monster Cat still owns the song. So if this is a huge, top of the chart single, I'm not really sure where the money goes back to the individual creator. I think that's some issues that need to be hammered out.
Yeah,
and it's when you go to their website, they basically advertise as allowing the artist to retain the copyright over the content they create. And I think, again, that, like I was saying, the devil's really in the details. It seems to me, especially hearing you guys talk, I didn't read the user agreement in any detail at all, but it seems to me that their advertising and their actual user agreement are starkly different from one another.
Marketing not talking to legal and vice versa.
That's never happened before now.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we have some tips and resources for you, and then we are out of here. Our tips, actually twofold of the week, are for folks interested in employment, maybe non-Uber, non-Curry oriented employment. The EFF is hiring, which is a pretty neat thing. Again, this is one of Corey's posts on Boing Boing, bringing this to our attention. Seeking a criminal defense staff attorney, a technology generalist, and two new activists at EFF. So if any of that sounds like it might be up your alley, definitely worth taking a look at. Also, if you are at a more preliminary stage of your career and looking for a really cool internship, the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard is seeking applications right now through February 12th for its 2016 summer internship program. And if you are watching the video with us right now, you are treated to their graphic of the dancing brain, the happy dancing brain chip. Definitely, if you're looking to have a career in the areas that we regularly and routinely discuss on this show, an internship at Berkman would be a great way to go. So we wanted to just bring that to your attention. And also, if you can get these in under your data caps, a couple of things we thought you might like to watch or keep an eye out for. Showtime is doing a documentary kind of series called Darknet, an 8-part docu-series exploring the dark side of technology. You can watch the trailer and see what you think. I'm sure it will be interesting. I'm a little bit skeptical that it might be playing on people's fears maybe a little bit more than it needs to. It covers themes such as biohacking, cyber kidnapping, digital warfare, online cults, pornography addiction, the webcam sex trade, and more. They really do want to show you the dark side of the web. One to keep an eye out for could be interesting. One that I have actually seen and can give you my own thumbs up is a newish show. I think it's had one season and is in its second now, with Mo Rocca as the host. It's on CBS every Saturday morning, called The Henry Ford Innovation Nation, that is all about cool gear, gadgets, new inventions, history of IP law, all kinds of great tidbits in this show. So if you're not watching this, it's definitely one to check out. Chris, have you ever seen Innovation Nation?
I have not. It seems fascinating. And I think I also need to go buy a subscription to Showtime now. So it seems like there's a lot of I just had a son 5 months ago, so I'm pretty busy with a newborn. But it looks like this will be on my queue of things to watch when I get a little more time on my hands.
Yes, maybe in earphones as you're rocking to sleep, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yes. All right, folks, that's going to be our show for the day. It's been such a pleasure. It's gone so fast. Anna Betancourt, wonderful to meet you and have you on the show.
Oh, wonderful to meet you too. Thank you very much for inviting me. I've been following you ever since I got an invitation back in the summer, and I think the program is wonderful. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is there anything that you want to let our listeners know about that's going on with you or any of the institutions you're involved with that you think they might want to look into or be aware of?
Oh, well, we certainly have like a lot of very interesting conferences in Mexico whenever you want to come, UNAM. But also we are about to launch an IP blog. So I will let you know on Twitter. So hopefully you will follow us. It will be both in English and Spanish. And I think it's interesting also for you to know what's going on in Latin America.
It definitely is. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Chris Koopman, real pleasure meeting you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a fun afternoon and I'm definitely going to have to brush up on this on the issues with Monster Cat. This seems like a pretty interesting issue to me.
I know. And you can just listen to their catalog while you're doing it. It's a win-win.
Exactly.
Chris, is there anything going on at Mercatus or George Mason that you want to let us know about?
There are always exciting things going on. For those of you interested in what I'm up to or what other of my colleagues are up to at Mercatus, I would recommend you go to the website right down here, mercatus.org, and check out what we're up to. I cover things from the sharing economy to daily fantasy sports regulation to all sorts of other interesting topics. At least I think they're interesting, having to do with regulation, innovation, and competition. So feel free to check us out at mercatus.org.
Thank you so much. And Emery, great to have you back on the show. Emery's going to be with me on a semi-regular basis for the time being, since Sarah is off having a child and otherwise being busy in her life. We will have her on from time to time, and we're working on a show to have her on again very soon. But I'm so glad, Emery, that you've got the time and are able to join us as co-host in the meantime.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, Sarah's left some mighty big shoes to fill, but it's a great time. I'm really glad to be here. A belated congrats to Chris for the 30 under 30 this year. I think we forgot to bring that up earlier. So also some cool stuff that he's doing. But yeah, I'm very excited to be here. I hope that I can contribute each week.
And you already are. So yes, and congratulations so much, Chris. That is great. And if you have not checked out Forbes 30 under 30 list in, it was technology policy. Is that the category?
Law and policy. So it was a mix of lawyers and academics and policy people who are covering some really, really interesting stuff. And I'm really honored to be listed alongside 29 others there.
I think there's actually another Mercatus fellow on the list as well. We're going to try to get her on later if I can get her email address. So
yes.
I might reach out to you.
Andrea Castillo, for those of you listening and any of you interested in cybersecurity or Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, the blockchain, all sorts of she's operating at the forefront of the internet in those issues. So I'd recommend you check her out. And I'd be more than happy to share her information with you anytime.
Oh, thank you so much. You're speaking Emery's language right there.
Absolutely.
We will definitely have fun. All right. Thanks so much, everyone. It's been a pleasure having you join us. If you have done so on Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, you have caught us as we recorded the show live, which it's always fun to have you do. Love having folks play along in our IRC. Love seeing your comments and questions there. For example, someone right now is asking, Reverb Mike is asking if Evan Brown is coming back. Yes, we would love to have Evan Brown come back any old time. And we'll be inviting him on again as soon as he can work us into his schedule. Evan was my co-host for a long, 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 long time as the show has rolled on here. So we'll definitely have him back. We love it when you can join us live, but don't worry if you can't, head on over to twit.tv/twill and our whole archive of shows featuring Evan and a whole amazing cast of luminaries is there for you to check out and enjoy at your leisure. I like going into the archive and seeing, first of all, how some of the issues have developed, how some of them don't go away and persist. And sometimes just going back and seeing, oh, were we really worried about that then? That's just not a problem anymore. So it's kind of neat to go back and see how our show and the law has developed over the years that we've been doing it. We will be doing it again next week. We hope you will join us then. In the meantime, you can get in touch with me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. I'm D Howell on Twitter. Those are great ways to reach out. Let me know about guest suggestions you might have, any topic suggestions, any feedback about things that we've discussed in the past. Love to hear from you there. You can also find us on Facebook and on Google+, where the show has pages. We hope that you will join us next week and every week when we do the show. We're so glad that you could join us today. Thank you so much and take care.